Okay, John, do you want to just head off? Okay.
Good morning. I would like to turn your attention to agenda paper 6. And in this paper, we are revisiting the commentator analysis for the discussion paper on creditors. I will go through the comments received in more detail than we did in September. And after that, Wayne will present the staff recommendations on how creditors should be addressed in other projects. If we start by going through the overview of the comments received, then respondents generally agreed that credit risk is a complex and controversial issue that has to be addressed. It should, however, not be done in isolation. There are also respondents that say that it's difficult to respond on this issue before the Fair Value project and the project to replace IS-39 have been completed. Respondents do also seem to be more interested in eliminating obvious day one gains or losses than having a consistent measurement approach. Most respondents' answers apply to all liabilities. However, some respondents limited their answers to financial liabilities and few either to pensions or insurance. Very few respondents identified the difference between a change in credit rating and a change in spread as an issue, and those who did said it was not worth separating. The respondents also had concerns about the interaction between this project and other ongoing projects. They thought that more work was needed in the conceptual framework project on liability measurement before this issue could be addressed. And on fair value, well, there the staff had some difficulty analyzing the responses on the interaction between fair value and credit risk. It seems that some respondents are opposed to fair value measurement of liabilities in general and are using credit risk as an argument for that view. Some agreed that fair value as defined by the board includes credit risk and they would therefore not favor its use when measuring liabilities. Some respondent would like a definition of fair value which does not include credit risk. Many respondents say that fair value should only be used in limited circumstances on subsequent remeasurement, that is for trading and similar liabilities, where it is possible to realize the changes in fair value. Some suggested using adjusted fair value on subsequent remeasurement where the effects of credit risk would be separated from other changes. Those respondents said that reporting changes in credit risk is both misleading and counterintuitive, and also that it is not useful information unless the entity can realize the gain by buying back its own debt. And some said that changes in credit risk should not be presented in the income statement, but should be reported in OCI. On the project to replace IS-39, respondents said it's difficult to answer on credit risk without knowing when and to what extent it will be used, and fair value will be used, and there were also the concerns about using fair value, especially on subsequent remeasurement. On other projects, there is little support for including credit risk. It would only be on initial measurement if the credit risk is priced into the transaction that gives rise to the liability. Other comments, many respondents argued against the inclusion of credit risk, especially on subsequent remeasurement, as it violates the notion of going concern. This is not a new argument, and the staff think that paragraph 23 of the framework does not include or exclude any measurement objective. So this is, in the staff opinion, not the strongest argument against including on credit risk. On the specific questions in the DP, whether to include credit risk on initial measurement, the majority of respondents said that credit risk should sometimes be included. Some said it should always, and most of those that said that were only replying on financial liabilities. Very few said never. On subsequent remeasurement, there were more divided views. The majority said that credit use should sometimes be included. A substantial part said it should never be included. And a small number said it should always be included, and those were again replying on, mainly on financial liabilities. On the methods to determine the amount of change in market interest rate attributable to the price of credit risk, many said that this was not relevant. This question was not relevant as they would not measure this change. The staff expected more attention to this question, given the fact that how many were opposed to include it on credit risk in subsequent remeasurement, and it seems that this question has not been very clear for the respondents. Majority of those who answered thought that the difference between the entity's borrowing rate and the relevant market rate should be used without explaining relevant market rate further. Few respondents pointed to the guidance in IFRS 7, and there were also other suggestions. On the preferred approach to measure liabilities and credit standing, the approach C, which was the frozen spread, was the favoured options. More than half of the respondents supported that view. However, many rejected all the approaches that were suggested. Those who rejected the approach did so in many cases on the basis that it would not work for financial liabilities, which would have to be valued at fair value, such as liabilities held for trading. The other two approaches did not get any support. Respondents said that they would increase complexity and not provide useful information. Respondents did not come up with other approaches, and if they were recommending changes to approach C, they were mostly to enable the fair value measurement of trading and derivative liabilities on subsequent remeasurement.
So I think what we should do is stop there before we go to the recommendations and ask if board members have questions or comments on the comment letters themselves.
I'll take this the rest of the way through the paper.
Wayne, I should have used the microphone. For those who are listening in, I've asked the board to comment on the analysis of the comment letters, then we'll move to the recommendation section.
Wayne, could I just ask about the frozen credit spread issue? I'm looking at paragraph 39 where it's quoted from the question. Subsequent measurements should incorporate changes in market interest rates, and yet at the bottom it talks about incorporating all changes in the risk-free rate. Now, that could be different, could it not? If my corporate bond rate moved, say, 1% more than the risk rate moved, what would the adjustment be in that situation? The guy's credit rating still stayed AA or whatever it was.
I think you're referring to the fact that a frozen credit spread could mark away from market, and that's true. We always intended that we would use a benchmark rate of some sort, and that would probably be risk-free. So if risk-free went one direction, perhaps down, and the credit spread on AA relative to risk-free went up, it's completely possible that a frozen credit spread measurement could mark away from market.
But it could also be done the other way, couldn't it? If you just took the market rates for AA bonds, you could use that one instead of the risk-free rate?
No, that would not be what we expected. The whole point was not. Because if you use double A's and I'm a double A, then you're incorporating changes in my credit spread, even though my credit rating hasn't changed. As John pointed out, we tried in the paper to direct people's attention to the fact that there were two things at work there. We couldn't find any significant comment from people that picked up on that point. A couple of the larger banks seemed to allude to it, I think the HSBC letter, for example. But most people just said, I just don't want any change in credit in there, period. Put them all together.
On this credit quality, credit rating, and then price of credit, you mentioned that quite a few times, and Jim has as well. Is perhaps the reason why people didn't mention it is because it's just an impossibility to split these two and identify the two components. I get the impression that a lot of people would like to think that their credit quality is the same and it's just that stupid market out there that's increased the spread, whereas in reality, the market's getting it right and the quality of the credit has fallen in spite of what the rating agencies may not have done to the rating. And conceptually, yes, I can understand that there is a price of credit and there is a risk element, but separating the two, I just think is an impossibility, and I wonder whether that's what the respondents to the discussion paper thought and that's why they didn't really separate.
It would be nice if they told us that. And as I say, I've talked to a couple of them offline, and I think that's what's driving some of their view. The market prices instantaneously, or very nearly so. Credit ratings happen once a year, or
well, credit ratings change once a year, but the risk is changing all the time, and
that's
and
what
rating
I meant.
Agencies
yeah.
catch up.
I was agreeing with you.
I see.
Yeah.
Now, in your analysis, you basically said the commentators support the initial recognitions at fair value, including credit risk, especially if there is a cash transaction. And then I look at the two paragraphs. I have one question. Paragraph 49 and 50. And I think you are talking about whether we should, when fair value is something, we should take into consideration credit risk or not. And in paragraph 50, you said, we are in a different position on this point than is the FSBs. And you quoted a paragraph from the conceptual framework number 7. And but I notice a difference. The quotation used is the initial measurement. You know, the divide opinions appears, you know, the people generally support initial measurement at fair value, including credit risk, but not subsequent measurement. And then you say that we have different positions, but the quotation used is, you know, definitely at initial measurement.
Trouble is, Wayne's not familiar with this document.
Two things. Number one, we're not to those paragraphs yet. But to clarify, the term, the paragraph refers to initial recognition and fresh start measurements, which is an expression that the FASB used for subsequent measurements that used all current information. So the paragraph does refer to both initial and subsequent. To the basic point, though, a lot of people did say, okay, I want credit risk at initial recognition because, of course, excluding it at initial recognition, if there's a cash price, means that the debits don't equal the credits and you'd have to do something else. And people didn't want to do that. That's why John's analysis talks about obvious day one gain or loss. If you take a different sort of a measurement, like an IAS 37 measurement or something in that ilk, and you say, I'm going to exclude credit risk by using the risk-free rate, you bury the same dangling debit in whatever the other side of the entry is. Now, you may not know what it would have been, otherwise, and I think that's what a lot of people said, is that if we can't see it, we don't know how to find it. Okay. But the point I think that John was making is that you're observing the same phenomenon. It's just in one, you've got tie the entry back to a debit or a credit to cash. And as Jim is fond of saying, if we've got a debit or credit to cash, we can often get the rest of the entry right.
It's well, is that half right?
To Stephen's point, Harris, I look, I think your analysis is an accurate one. I'm very frustrated reading the comment letters, but I also think that a great many of them didn't understand the points. Some did. But I actually think that we've collectively all grown up using slang rather than being precise about what we were talking about, and that's what does this. I actually think what people don't want to do is ever remeasure a liability. In other words, particularly financial. I borrowed it, $100,000 at 6%. That's what I owe. I don't want to remeasure anything. I just want to leave it alone. You know? And they just didn't say that. But that is what they want. What they really want is so-called amortized costs, be done with it. But the slang was to deprecate any remeasurement of a liability. We started this, oh my God, if I change my credit risk, I'll have a gain. How counterintuitive that is. And that just catches on. So that it always the buzzwords were change in credit risk. Not change in price, but they really didn't want to change anything, including the risk-free rate. So even someone borrowing at the risk-free rate, if that was possible, they don't want to mark for changes in the risk-free rate. They don't want to mark for anything. And that's why I think actually inventing something that freezes part of a change in interest rate isn't particularly productive. It isn't responsive to what people really want to do most of the time, okay, unless they want to do something else and then they want an option to do that. But the people that really didn't want to do this don't want to mark for anything. And they just didn't tell us that, although some kind of did.
Just like to say, Jan, I thought it's a very good summary of the comment. That is very good analysis that you did there. But seeing as we've changed now to instead of talking about what's in the analysis to speculate about what people didn't write in the analysis, I've got some comments to add on to Jim's as well. I think in some cases there are people who don't want to change the measurement of a certain liability. I think they might be willing to remeasure where there's an estimate, so the amount is uncertain, but that's outside the scope of financial instruments. But there are also those who, in fact, I think are motivated more by the, not don't remeasure, but because they're measuring assets and there are liabilities, their own liabilities in the same portfolio, they want to avoid the volatility of price changes between the two portfolios. So if interest rates move, that's one thing because that's in both the portfolios. But if the credit spread changes or the credit rating changes of their own debt, then they're concerned about that because it throws up as an aberration. It's been argued as a gain, but it's also, it will come through, and it is coming through at the moment as a loss. And that's the thing of concern. So that's focused people's attention then on whether or not you can actually provide useful information as to whether you can ever realize the gain that is going through. So some of the people might have been satisfied if we'd said, as we've opened the window, book all of these credit losses through OCI because at least they don't affect our earnings. And we'll continue to remeasure them because it's easier to do that. But I am troubled that we didn't get enough response to how would you measure the effect of freezing the credit spread. Because what we otherwise are going to end up with is a measurement of something that doesn't really exist and doesn't really represent anything at all. It's an assumed calculation, assuming that the credit spread hadn't moved. This is what the instrument would be priced at, as opposed to what it is actually priced at. So that seems suboptimal. But I'm sorry, that's only my speculation about what people would have liked to have said.
Come back on John's comment. I think there are two difficulties as I reread the comment letters about the frozen credit spread. Number one, it was compared to two examples that we knew going in had very, very little support, but that had very noisy support in either the actuarial community or among some academics. So it was compared against two fairly ugly alternatives. It had to look good. That's and many of the comments, if you try and read them and put the tone of voice of the speaker in there, you get that of, okay, if these are my only choices, this is the obvious one. The other difficulty, I think, is that it's never been exposed in the context of a specific project. And I think if people thought of it in the context of a specific project and said, all right, now I know how to think about it in the context of financial instruments or pensions or whatever, I think we might get more thoughtful responses on it. But if there are no other comments from the board, we'll go on to the recommendation section, which starts at paragraph 42. And I'd like to take these one at a time. The first is the general recommendation of having issued this document and analyzed the comment letters, what happens next in terms of a separate work stream, separate task for the staff, our recommendation is nothing. We've done what we set out to do. We've gotten the comments back. Obviously, many of the commentators were concerned about their ability to answer the question absent a broader question about what the objective of liability measurement is generally. And to a degree, the staff agrees with them. It would be premature, in our view, to reach a general conclusion about credit risk without having a general conclusion about what we think liability measurement means. So our first recommendation is that as a separate work effort, we've done what we set out to do and we should stop. And we'll feed this into, it feeds into other projects, but for now we're done. And I think I'd like to stop there and take that as the first recommendation, and then we'll go on.
Okay, bearing in mind our workload, any disagreements? Jim?
I don't disagree, but my suggestion is,
since this is the first board paper in a year and a half, I think that I agreed with all of the staff recommendations, put Wayne back on the technical staff instead of being warm and cuddly Wayne wandering the world, please.
It's the warm and cuddly bit is the problem, yeah. Any disagreement with the recommendation? Okay, thank you.
That's okay, to the extent that this conceptual framework thing doesn't drag on for years and years and
no,
years.
We haven't got to that yet.
Okay, I mean, we agree on this recommendation provided that.
Okay. Okay, carried.
The next question, obviously having decided that, is we can't just quit thinking about this issue. It comes up in specific projects. And the first one and the obvious one is what to do about credit risk in the fair value project. The staff brought you an analysis of a different approach to credit risk and fair value back in December. That's what gave rise to this exercise. My recollection was that at the time the vote was 13-1 against the staff position. Don't see a lot of chance of that changing, and so our recommendation is that in terms of the definition of fair value, that we not amend it with regard to credit risk. Now we'll talk about the application in a minute, but in terms of the definition of what fair value means, many of the constituents did say, yes, we agree, if it's fair value, it has to use credit and or performance risk. But we don't like fair value or something like that. So in terms of the definition, we don't recommend any change. In terms of the application of that definition, we think the board should make a commitment that it will always consider whether or not fair value alone is the relevant measurement attribute or whether it should be modified. We have precedent for that. fair value net of selling costs. We exposed fair value assuming the plan doesn't change in the employee benefits. So the board has shown itself willing, and as has the FASB on occasion, of saying it's fair value, comma, modifier. And I think the board should, our recommendation is that the board should commit to making that same consideration whenever it uses fair value of liabilities. So we'll stop there, ask for board comment.
Okay, the Wayne, I don't think you mentioned the conceptual framework, did you, the B one, or was that part of the first one?
Part of the first one.
Well, is everyone happy with that?
Well, I'd like to understand, what are we saying?
I agree with what you're saying, sure. But does that mean we now direct the staff working on the measurement phase of the project to encompass that issue?
If they're going to think about liabilities, they have to.
Well, I agree, but I don't see anything in what has appeared before us yet.
Yes.
It's very high level. This is getting into the detail, and that's fine. But then that decision needs to be conveyed as a result of this board's decision immediately.
As I say, I thought that was inherent in the first recommendation.
I don't have a problem with what you propose, but I have a problem with words. I think any time we call a thing fair value modified by such and such, it's going to create a lot of difficulties in the public. I think we should try to define the attribute we use in each case, maybe if it is a little lengthy, without using the word fair value.
That could be tricky, Gilbert.
Okay, but it's a question of clarification for the public.
Well, we look forward to your drafting and...
Thank you.
Thank you. I think if it's in the conceptual framework, we'll have to ask Wayne to help out in this one, because I'm not sure. This project's going to move very fast. If that goes, well, it's not moving very fast anyway, but if that goes into it, it could be a bit much. So in concept, do we put it into the conceptual framework project? No.
We're back on the previous recommendation. I don't know, having had something to do with a conceptual framework on this topic, I would tell you that you cannot address liability measurement at a conceptual level without thinking about credit and performance risk. And so if it's at a conceptual level, then it belongs in the conceptual framework project. Was the point of the staff recommendation. I thought that part of it was non-controversial, I guess.
As Warren said, up to now we have not seen anything yet. And the only impression I got is we start with mixture attributes models, and then within the second categories we have different current measures, but not mention anything related to the credit risk.
The reason why I was nodding my head in no is that if you put it in conceptual framework, it might be a few sentences or a paragraph that you allocate to it, and there you will say that, you know, fair value should incorporate credit. Okay, but the problem is not there. The problem comes in the each project application stage. So by putting a statement there, I think it can be easily accomplished, and perhaps may not go very far, because every time you have a project, you're going to pick it up and you're going to again re-debate it. So that's the reason I was saying that, you know, it may not serve a huge purpose by putting it in conceptual framework.
I actually agree with Wayne, but I don't see how we can answer the measurement question in the conceptual framework without thinking about this. Because implicit in looking at the objective of how you measure a liability is, presumably, what is going to happen to that liability, how it's going to be settled, how it's initially recognized, and how it changes over time. Now, I'm not going to presuppose the outcome of that debate on the concept, because it may say that we disregard own credit for whatever reason, but I think it has to ask the question about that, because it's an implicit part of the determination of a liability. At the standards level, I would agree with you later, then we have to consider how we're going to apply the concept at the standards level. And one of the considerations in that might be the difficulty the practical difficulty of estimating the impact of credit on the change of an uncertain liability. But whatever it is, it has to be dealt with, I think, first at the conceptual level, and then the detail, how to apply that concept, will come standard by standard.
Okay, I see some nods there. Could we just say who would disagree with the proposal in B? Okay, we're on to C now. Anyone want to comment on that who would disagree? Okay.
David, could I just ask for a clarification, because the Fair Value Measurement Team haven't yet completed their analysis of the comment letters on that project. And it's just conceivable that they might find something new in the comment letters. So I don't think we should close off the possibility that they might find something. I don't expect them to, personally, but I don't think we should close that off now.
Yeah, I think perhaps my wording was not as good as it should have been. That's exactly what I meant, that nothing as a consequence of this exercise leads us to believe that we should change the definition. Obviously, the Fair Value Team will carry that to its ultimate.
Gavin? Okay. Any other comments? Okay. D?
Okay, the next section is other measurements, and here there are a couple of things that I'd like to spend a little time with you on. And this is the point at which Wei Gu raised his question. We are in a different position here conceptually than the FASB is. Concept Statement 7 is absolute. And it was written that way because the five board members who voted for it wanted it that way. You cannot use present value, you follow Concept 7, to do an initial or a fresh start measurement with any objective in mind other than fair value. And then it goes on to say, and by the way, fair value of a liability always includes credit risk. So the FASB has, in Concept 7, said if you're looking at future cash flows to do a measurement, you can only have one objective. We don't have that same restriction. And so we can consider, without violating our conceptual imperative, different types of objectives for liability measurements. And as a matter of fact, you've been doing that in both your IAS 37 and I think in the insurance discussions, embracing measurements. And if you do that, there's no imperative to include own credit risk. You have to think about whether you should, but there's no imperative. One of the things that we want to talk about is, again, making the statement that you intend to think explicitly about that in every project. Because I think a lot of the discomfort that people feel is that current measurement includes credit risk, and that they don't understand that that has to be debated separately. The other point, and this is at paragraph 53 in the paper, that looking back is the second thing that we could have done a better job of talking to people about in the discussion paper. And that's the dual notions of performance risk and credit risk. Now, in one sense, anything that causes an entity to fail to pay its obligations is credit risk. It's an all-encompassing notion. The FASB inserted a notion of performance risk, and the only way I've been able to intellectualize it is with the kind of example that's in paragraph 54. Pardon me? Well, I wanted to make it an extreme example so that the differences were obvious. If we have a liability that has outcomes that range from 5 million to 5 billion, and we then say, in the estimate of the entity, any amount in excess of 1 billion will bankrupt us, it's not worth thinking about. Be one way of analyzing it. In a fair value context, as we understand the fair value approach, fair value, you're thinking of somebody about like you as your counterparty when we talk about liabilities. And so those black swan possibilities in excess of $1 billion all attach a zero probability if we're using cash flows to estimate performance risk. So I say, yeah, there are probabilities out there in excess of $1 billion, but the probability that they will result in a cash outflow for me is zero. And so fair value includes that, and I think that's what FASB was thinking about when they thought about performance risk as separate from credit risk. If, again, it has the result of causing you not to pay. Now, if, on the other hand, we said we want a measurement that explicitly excludes performance risk, then it seems to me that the logical extension is you have to include all of those possible outcomes up to $5 billion with their relative probability. And that will affect the measurement. That is a different way of excluding a kind of credit risk. It's in the cash flows rather than the interest rate. But as we've said all along, as long as you only put things in one place, you can put them in either. I don't think a lot of people, I don't remember any comment letter that focused on this dimension of it, but it clearly is one, and it's one that Peter has tried to raise on a number of cases. You can have situations in which you have probable future outcomes, or outcomes with a probability, that you don't think you will be able to meet. But if you're going to explicitly exclude credit risk, in my mind, then you have to include all of those probabilities. What we're asking the board is, though, when we are doing things at other than fair value, we have to make sure that we explicitly address these issues. We're not asking you to reach a conclusion, but project by project, if we're using a measurement other than fair value, we have to address these and make sure that they're explicitly in the document. We can't expect our constituents to try and figure out whether or not. So with that, I'll stop.
Are there the performance risk, credit risk distinction certainly could include the example, absolutely. I don't know whether that was in people's minds or not. I didn't think so exactly, but sort of in a way, because I think two things were going on, and I frankly don't know how you can we could actually have concluded that you absolutely must be after fair value if you use a present value calculation, because pensions are a present value calculation and you're obviously not going after fair value. So there's a bit of disingenuous thought going on there, it seems to me. And I was probably one of them being disingenuous, because I'm sure I know I was one of the five. But the period of time was looking at other post-employment benefits. And a good many people said, if the healthcare cost trend rate is as it exists, there's no way I'm going to meet this obligation. I mean, right now you're telling me healthcare costs are going to do this. Given what I've promised, if they do that, I'll be broke. So that's another one of your $5 billion types. So it wasn't quite that bad. And the other one was remediation liabilities. The people said, you know, they can order me to clean this up, but I may not be able to. And remember, that was at the time that we had some of these sites that were so toxic that if someone was deemed to be responsible for it, they would have been out of business, or and worse than out of business, they don't know whether they could physically do what they were required to do. So there was the notion, it seemed to me, of physical inability to perform, not just financial inability. And I don't know how to deal with those things. That's much better done at the conceptual level than here.
I thought non-performance risk was even wider than Jim is suggesting, and that is that there are circumstances when I have liabilities to employees, suppliers, where I can put pressure on these people to mitigate the liability. So it may be in situations where the post-employment benefits have just got so expensive, it may not. But the ability to say to employees, look, either we renegotiate this or we withdraw these benefits or you don't get a pay rise, you have leverage over these people in a way that you don't have leverage over in terms of a financial liability. So my question is that interpretation of non-performance risk correct? Does it encompass that, and is that something that we would incorporate in discussion in the framework? And there was one other thing. You mentioned the US framework and CON 7. Are you saying that the US framework says that the initial recognition of all liabilities is fair value, and therefore that includes credit risk? Because that's not what happens in US GAAP, particularly in terms of pensions and non-financial liabilities. I was a bit confused by what you said in terms of concern.
I think, number one, the conceptual framework in the FASB context is a forward-looking and not authoritative. So it doesn't attempt to reconcile what's already in the standards, especially something as unique as employee benefits accounting. I think in most other places, at least for a few years, the FASB tried very hard. And so, for example, in their decommissioning document, the initial recognition was fair value. Now, their subsequent measurement was kind of an unusual one, but initial recognition was fair value. So I think they tried to follow that and to be consistent with it. But looking back at previous standards, no, they didn't try to.
But that's very different from the message that we got in those comment letters, which is that non-financial liabilities
right.
should not include credit standards.
No, our commentators were pretty heavily skewed to say non-financial liabilities should not include credit risk. Some used credit and performance risk apparently interchangeably. Others shifted to the FASB language and used performance risk as the term of art. So it is kind of hard, and we didn't do a very good job in retrospect about separating those two out for them and helping them understand the potential implications of it. I didn't think he had 75 relatives to the right hand.
Before I say something different, I have a question. So you mentioned about pension, but pension measurement is in the U.S. literature is a fair value. Therefore. This line of thinking does not apply to the pension measurement, I think.
No, it doesn't. And the pension measurement was adopted in the United States roughly 15 years before Concept 7. And as I say, the FASB has never tried in the concept statements to go back and reconcile them with all of existing practice. They've always said that they're forward-looking, and they will attempt to apply the discipline on new standards.
But you know that under our thinking, unit credit method is. No, is.
Did you take him out last
time? I'm sorry. I need a water. But obviously, it's not the fair value measurement because it included the sort of the future increase of the salary. So I think that that is not the issue what we are discussing under this sort of fair value measurement, I think. Am I wrong?
Well, the objective of
Yeah, the first argument you have to have in employee benefit accounting is whether or not what you're doing meets the definition of a liability before you have to argue about whether or not you're fair valuing it. And but it's clear that neither IAS 19 nor FAS 87 and 106 are they're not fair value documents.
And the coercion factor, yeah. Stephen said, part of that.
Probably, yeah.
So then I would like to get into my point is, say, we are in a D, I think. So I say C says you think that we should include the sort of the this kind of credit risk in a definition of fair value. But now in D, in application, we can be a little bit flexible. So I understand some example, but in case of frozen spread credit method is how we can rationalize, because the say definition of is included sort of credit risk, but this frozen spread method is just to take the day one and then a credit risk and fix it. So it's what is the rationale of the application? I'm not quite sure.
Okay, I think we had moved past that, but I thought we had had decisions on C and D already. But my point was that I think if, number one, that the board should always consider whether or not they're applying fair value or fair value with some modification. And we should tell people that we plan to go through that exercise. The second part was that one of the weaknesses in the way we presented frozen credit spread is that it didn't get perhaps the quality of response that we might otherwise have expected, or that we would expect if it was exposed in the context of a specific project. And so all we're recommending here is that the board acknowledge that it has to think this through on a project-by-project basis. And if we put it in the context of a specific project, then people would have a better, I think, ability to comment on it.
So that means a criteria, how to adjust the definition of the fair value is based on people's response, or there is some criteria? Yeah, that is my point.
Well, and we did not attempt in the paper, in the discussion paper, or in this memo to develop specific criteria, because we think those would likely be driven by the instrument and the measurement in question. So all we're suggesting is that we make it clear to our constituents that going forward we will always consider it in this kind of a context.
Yeah. I'd like to go back to the point made by Steve about non-performance risk, and I'd like to be clear in my mind. Maybe it is a cross-cutting issue, how that differs from the way we approach liabilities in IAS 37, where we have a probability-weighted average of possible scenario. One of the possible scenarios is, yes, I'm going to renegotiate that contract. I will get out of it at a lower price than what it would otherwise be. I could have that scenario with a certain probability estimate, and that would be consistent with the way we measure IAS 37 liabilities. So why is this matter really different in the approach? I don't see why. No, but I'd like to have a confirmation that this is part of the way we measure liabilities in general.
We might want to come back to talk about that in the next session as well, but our original plan for IAS 37 was not to get into the credit risk discussion at all. It's not mentioned explicitly in existing
plan. Performance risk, not credit risk.
Credit or performance, either. And it's not mentioned explicitly in the exposure draft, as far as I remember. And so, and we know that in practice people aren't considering it as well. That's the message we've been getting fairly consistently. And so our original plan was not to discuss it at all before finalising IS 37. And I think that's what we would still plan to do if we go straight to a standard now. If we go straight to an ED, we'll have the question whether we need to address it in some way, at least discuss it somehow. And I think you could possibly go either way on that. You could say we'll just stay silent on it. But I think we have to discuss it in the insurance context, and it's been one of the hot buttons in the insurance project, and we're relying on 37. So I think we have to discuss it explicitly in one place or the other. And I suspect it may come back as a sweep issue next month on 37, possibly, depending on whether you have this discussion here finishes. Joan, do you disagree with anything I've just said?
Like others have said, for me, non-performance risk is, or let me say it the other way, I feel credit risk is a subset of non-performance risk, at least in my mind. So the fact that there could be reasons other than credit, somebody can need not perform. So that's the reason I feel it's non-performance risk. But I want to go to the example in para 54 that you have mentioned. The $5 million to $5 billion. So I was having some intellectual confusion in my mind on this issue, because let's say that expected cash outflow is actually $2 billion. You really have a liability of $2 billion in this example, but the company is unable to pay anything more than $1 billion because that will be a bankruptcy situation. So if you are assigning probabilities, In realistic terms, you may not be able to pay anything more than $1 billion, because that will throw you into bankruptcy. So in a probability assignment, maybe anything more than $1 billion, let's say you put in a value of zero. What I'm struggling is that with the definition of a liability, with the definition of the expected cash outflow, and let's say the true liability is $2 billion, you really contaminated I don't want to go into IAS 37 discussion, but I just want to use in a generic terms. You really contaminated a nuclear site, and you have to pay $2 billion. That's what the government has assessed on you. So even though the expected cash flow is $1 billion, what would you book on your financial statements? I know the expected cash outflow is only $1 billion, but what would you book on the day one?
I think the staff recommendation is that we should not leave that question up to constituents. We ought to tell them what we expect. As Peter has said, I think practice generally would say, well, if it's above $1 billion, I can't pay it, so it can't be my liability, so it's $1 billion. But in a non-financial liability, I think that's where some practice is. My point is that, as I say, we shouldn't leave it up to our constituents to figure that out. If it's the measurement can be either, we ought to tell them what we expect them to do, rather than to argue about necessarily what our current standard says.
Recommendation other than saying that we need to come up with a recommendation.
We need to address credit and performance risk anytime we have a cash flow based measurement, and we need to tell people how we expect them to deal with it. That's what the staff recommendation is.
I had a couple of thoughts as I read the example also that really resonated with me. I used to follow two industries where this issue was fairly commonplace, the U.S. tobacco industry and the U.S. pharmaceutical industry. And as an analyst, it was a pretty common occurrence that you would have to sit down sometimes and play the what-if game and, in fact, record a liability on the balance sheet of a company that would, in fact, lead it to present an insolvent balance sheet picture. And we all recognize that the job of the CFO was to try to avoid that scenario. So I'm struggling a little bit with the idea of these two scenarios, one where the recordation of a liability that would essentially include all the cash scenarios would not bankrupt the company, okay, albeit a black swan event, and that scenario which would. And I guess the question is then, would our answer differ? Would the outcome differ? And that's essentially what I'm concluding too, that the answer shouldn't differ. So I'm troubled by excluding those cash scenarios, including the black swan possibilities, from this kind of an exercise, and therefore, in as you've put it here, incorporating performance risk. So I think that for many of the arguments that you've laid out here, I think I agree with you that we have to come up with a recommendation. But my recommendation wouldn't be to not to limit the scenarios to those that would simply lead to an insolvent picture.
I think that in the that was described, you have a liability of $2 million, but you cannot afford to pay more than one. To me, it clearly indicates you are no longer a going concern, and it really points to not being a going concern. It doesn't point to say my liability is $1 million. That's not possible.
I didn't realize that Wayne's paper was going to prompt us to debate whether performance obligations or the like were to be included. And, you know, this board has done that on a couple of occasions. We got to the thing pension liability is contracted for to eliminate the very ability that Stephen suggested employers almost always have in that relationship. So I think all Wayne's saying is that this is an issue beyond anything that ought to be a short-term solution, and it probably is going to be idiosyncratic to the liability, and we ought to accept that. Now, maybe the framework team will tell us otherwise, but we ought to accept that. In many respects, one of the things we haven't properly come to grips with is the distinction between whether I can't perform or I have an ability to get out of performing. And those are two different things. Maybe I could perform, but I think I've got a way to get out of performing. And those are not the same thing. And that's the tobacco versus the pension versus a whole bunch of the remediation thing. And Wayne, I think, was saying these things aren't issues that are going away. You got to think about them.
Well, I agree with that, but I think also punting the issue to the conceptual framework until we come to a resolution there, we don't apply it or address it in the context of 37, as Philippe brought up, or in the insurance industry, I think is not being responsive to our role. I think we have to.
We're just going to get the...
Well, as Wayne told us, that's essentially what this board is essentially destined to do.
Well, I think the point...
It didn't work on the framework.
The point that the staff was trying to make here with the recommendation was not to punt it. Instead, it was to say that we have to explicitly include it. Anytime we're going to use cash flows to measure a liability, our constituents ought to know which cash flows we expect them to use. That's likely to be, as Jim said, idiosyncratic to particular projects. And all we're saying is that the recommendation is that we agree that we've got to think about it in these individual projects and that we will do so explicitly.
I agree with that.
Yeah, I
agree as well. I think it's an interesting, very interesting discussion, and you've certainly made me think about something I really haven't thought much about in the past, that's for sure. But it raises some very interesting questions, I think, because if you're talking about, you know, the possibility, probability of the liability getting to a point where it would cause the entity to go into bankruptcy, then you're speculating on whether a bankruptcy would occur. If you're in a regulated industry like insurance, whether the government will step in and avoid bankruptcy occurring and so on. endless possibilities, perhaps.
Well, so, to interrupt, but it's the other way around, actually. The moral hazard issue that exists today, some of the financial writers in the States or the economists are talking about, a bank probably really doesn't have a liability for their deposits because the government will do it. So, you know, the fact that they contracted to pay it back, they're probably not a probable future outflow.
That's another perspective, actually. It's an interesting one. I think it was referred to in a speech last night in Edinburgh, if you're listening.
Okay. Does anyone disagree with the recommendations then?
Can I just ask for another clarification? D talks about considering the application in measurements would otherwise be at fair value. Are we talking there about projects or are we talking about standards that are already on the books or both?
My intention was that it embraced future projects, not standards
already. Absolutely. Yeah,
we can decide what future means. Is that okay?
I think
it means haven't started yet, maybe.
After today.
Okay. Well, thank you, John. Thanks, Wayne, for the paper. It obviously engendered a lot of discussion. It's a tricky area, this one. Thanks very much. John?